Israel has built 102 new settlements and expanded settlements by almost 100%.
What they do is they take her words and they twist them to say that, you know, Bush knew in advance, but then they don't tell you why they went after this woman, because she was investigating something else. She was in charge of a congressional investigation, something called Barrick Gold Mining.
I saw others who killed civilians outright when they could have shot at the tires of an advancing car.
You are not diminishing the threat of terrorism. You are increasing the threat of terrorism. After all, terrorism does not start with September 11th.
Apparently, 3,000 lives lost are not enough to get answers. Apparently, more people need to be killed for this country to shape up its act.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, June 24th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Iraqis ambushed British soldiers in southern Iraq today, killing six troops and wounding eight others in the deadliest day of combat for coalition forces since the fall of Saddam Hussein. The attacks near the town of Amara were a surprise outbreak of violence in Iraq's largely Shiite south, which has been quiet even as American troops in central and western Iraq have come under near daily hit-and-run attacks. The British, who control the south, have felt secure enough to patrol the country's second biggest city, Basra, without flak jackets or helmets. The six British soldiers were killed in the first two attacks. British Army Captain Dennis Abbott said he said Iraqis fired on the British troops in that attack, but he declined to give further details. The current number of dead and wounded U.S. soldiers in Iraq is acceptable to the majority of Americans, according to a recent poll. About half of those asked in a Washington Post-ABC News poll say the deaths are acceptable, but that's fewer than the two-thirds who found them acceptable in April. And while there is concern over the growing number of casualties among U.S. troops in Iraq, it has failed to dampen American support for the use of military force in neighboring Iran. President Bush last week said the rest of the world should join the U.S. in declaring that it will not tolerate nuclear weapons in Iran. And according to that Washington Post-ABC News poll, most Americans agree. 56% back the use of military force to prevent Iran from developing nuclear weapons. The poll also found that support for Bush's handling of the current war in Iraq is slipping. Two out of three people interviewed approve of the way Bush is handling the occupation of Iraq. That's down from 75% in late April. President Bush banked $4 million for his reelection campaign yesterday, telling donors in the city scarred by September 11th that, quote, terrorists declared war on the United States of America, and war is what they got. Bush was careful not to directly mention the September 11th attacks or the demolished World Trade Center in his campaign speech. Aides have said they won't use the attacks as campaign fodder, but the fight against terrorism that was prompted by September 11th loomed large in Bush's speech about 80 blocks from ground zero. The president opened his address by saying, quote, we have captured or killed many key leaders of Al-Qaeda, and the rest of them know we're hot on their trail, unquote. Governor George Pataki was explicit in citing September 11th as a reason why Bush should be reelected. Thank God we have a president who, when our country was attacked in a way we never experienced before, understood it's not a time for national hand-wringing, it's a time for national leadership, Pataki said. The raucous crowd of New Yorkers, mostly wearing dark suits, responded to Bush with calls of, we love you, Mr. President, and four more years. The president's war on terrorism is losing its appeal, however, among some of the families who lost loved ones in the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Centers. Many are rapidly losing faith in the Bush administration's willingness to get to the bottom of the terrorist attacks. Kristen Breitweiser is the widow of Ronald Breitweiser, who was working in Tower 2 on the 94th floor when the plane attacked the building. Breitweiser and about a dozen other families had a rare face-to-face meeting recently with FBI Director Robin Mueller.
The FBI had reached out to some family groups to have a meeting. I think they wanted to bring us up to speed where their investigation with Moussaoui is. Certainly, we had questions that we wanted to ask of the director and the other people that were in the room. And it was really just the first opportunity for the families, after over 21 months, to speak with the FBI about the investigation, about the Moussaoui trial, and to try and get them to answer some of our questions.
What sort of concerns were you able to raise?
You know, it went across the spectrum. Certainly, one of the things that was raised was the Moussaoui trial. We're very frustrated that, you know, when we ask questions to certain individuals, we are told that we can't be given those answers because it could conflict with the Moussaoui trial. We understand that, you know, that's an important facet, but by the same token, you know, it's come to my understanding that overseas foreign governments and entities are not providing information for that trial because we're seeking the death penalty. I have concerns with that. I'm concerned that we're possibly putting our nation at risk and people's lives at stake because we're seeking the death penalty, when if we offered him life in prison, maybe we would get some more information. One of the other problems, at least that we tried to bring up, is the fact that he's never been even offered a plea bargain. I mean, he's one individual who has apparently an awful lot of information, and for some of us, we feel that we'd like to get some information from him and maybe not have the death penalty, not have this complete blackout from gaining information and access and getting answers to our questions.
Mm-hmm.
We were told over and over, we can't answer that because of the Moussaoui trial. We can't answer that because it could hurt sources and methods. We can't answer that because your question in and of itself is based on misinformation from the press.
Mm.
And I think at this point, we would appreciate the FBI having a press conference and setting the record straight as to what is fact and what is fiction. Because apparently some of the questions that we asked at that meeting, we were told, are misinformation.
Well, I want to get one thing straight. So you're saying that you and possibly several other of the members there who lost loved ones on September 11th are willing to go for a lesser penalty?
I don't think it's a lesser penalty. I'm just saying that I think for, you know, in particular to just be going for the death penalty, there are some foreign governments that are against the death penalty. They're withholding information that they have. You know, that information, if given to our government, could possibly save lives. And I'd certainly rather save, you know, 100, a couple thousand American U.S. lives by getting this information as opposed to getting the death penalty for Moussaoui. He's the only person at this point who we have in custody connected to this. You know, he could have a wealth of information, and you need to do a cost-benefit analysis. And if it means that he spends the rest of his life in prison, maybe that the detriment to that is outweighed by lives being saved from the information that we could glean by not seeking the death penalty.
Do you think your position is rare, or are
I don't know. I mean, I know that in the meeting, we were very frustrated. You have to understand, we're asking questions about the building's collapse. We're asking questions about the fireman tape. We're asking questions about the flights, you know, Flight 77, Flight 11, the time frame, NORAD's response. And everything we ask, we're told that they can't give us an answer because it conflicts with the Moussaoui trial. You know, at one point we were like, well, you know what, extradite them. Send them to a foreign country and at least give us some answers so that the American public can be informed and that we can be safer. Look, the reality of the situation is if the U.S. government made the threats that were readily apparent in the summer of 2001, lives would have been saved. I'm not saying every life. I'm saying lives would have been saved. You know, my husband was in Tower 2. When that plane hit Tower 1, he probably would have immediately fled out of Tower 2 because he would have known that we were standing under a threat of an attack. How many people would have thought twice when they got on the plane and saw a group of Middle Eastern men? How many baggage checkers would have been extra vigilant? And this goes to informing the public. You know, we can get the most information possible out there as to what we are standing in front of at this point, then I believe that we should have that and we should tell the public.
Well, what about this 900-page congressional study on the intelligence failures leading up to September 11th? It was completed late last year, but the White House has refused to release it to the public. Why do you suppose they're holding on to that?
I don't necessarily know the fact that the White House is refusing to give it to the public. I think what it comes down to is there are certain assertions of privilege, whether it's congressional privilege or executive privilege, and the agencies are involved with not wanting certain things to go out. And I think that it probably has to do with embarrassment. And I've said on the record numerous times before, I really think that embarrassment needs to yield to public safety. And, you know, I feel terrible that people may be embarrassed, but, you know, you need to have some self-examination. You need to fix the problems. And you need to be a big enough person to say, look, I screwed up. This happened on my watch, but I'm doing everything in my ability to make sure that this damn well doesn't happen again. And I do not see that down in Washington. I don't see it anywhere. And, you know, we're 21 months out. We do not have any answers. This nation is no safer than it was prior to 9/11. And that's a problem. I still have to raise a child here. I still have to live here. And I don't feel safe. And, you know, my husband was killed. How many more lives have to be taken before we make this nation safe?
Do you place the responsibility on the Bush administration for not moving forward with this investigation? Or
look, certainly in an ideal world, the administration would have set up an investigation, you know, the day after the attacks. I mean, certainly the Pearl Harbor attack got an investigation immediately. They had several investigations. The space shuttle blew up. They had an investigation within 24 hours. They've already released their report. They got $50 million for the space shuttle. Not that they didn't deserve that. But, you know, it was a little bothersome that we had to go down to Washington and lobby for this independent commission, that we have to still lobby to get the release of the 800-page Jicky report. Would I have liked an investigation the day after the attack? Certainly. Would I feel a lot safer? Certainly. Why hasn't it happened? I don't know. I have serious reservations about this country's safety at this point. We're not looking at the problems. We're not doing a self-examination. We are not looking back. We're restructuring agencies. We're restructuring the FAA. We're restructuring the INS. Nothing is getting done. And, you know, we need leaders who are going to actually face these problems and fix them, even if it means it's at the cost of big business.
Well, there is, of course, President Bush's war on terrorism. And as the U.S. replaces the government of Saddam Hussein and looks forward to expanding this war on terror to Iran, Syria, and North Korea, it would seem only to make sense that the original terrorist attack that started this all would be fully investigated.
Well, I would hope that this would be fully investigated. I fully anticipate that it will, because we're not going to give up until it is fully investigated, until we have accountability, and we have responsibility on behalf of our leaders, not just the administration, Congress, the agencies, Director Mueller. We want accountability. We want responsibility from the people who are paid to make this nation safe. And we're not giving up until we get that. And, you know, yes, it saddens me that we went to war in Afghanistan. It saddens me that we went to war in Iraq. You know, certainly we haven't gotten bin Laden yet. We haven't gotten Hussein. Apparently we can't find the weapons of mass destruction. You know, I am of the personal opinion that you need to make your homeland safe. You need, before you strike out on the offensive, you better make sure that your defense is lock solid. You know, and I just, you know, I was quoted in the papers early on about the war in Iraq. It made me very nervous. I think it's inciting terrorism. But, you know, that's not my decision to make. Certainly some terrible things were happening there. There were human rights violations. Frankly, there's human rights violations all around the world. But I really think that before you go out on the offensive, you really need to make sure your defense, your homeland, is tight and solid and safe. And I don't know how anyone can say that America is that way right now.
Are you at all sensitive to the reality that perhaps FBI Director Robert Mueller is holding on to some of this information out of concern for national security?
Listen, I have absolutely no problem with information being withheld to the public for reasons of national security. That is a legitimate reason. But I do have concerns with the fact that there are so many things that the public is not aware of. There are so many capabilities and capacities of our intelligence agencies that the American people are not privy to. And national security is a very convenient way to not answer people's questions. If it is legitimately national security, I have no problem with that. If it is just an excuse and you just say national security and then it doesn't go any further, I have a problem with that. I want this country to be safe. I want to know that my child is safe growing up here.
Do you
That's what you do as a parent. You make sure that a child's tomorrow is safe.
Do you feel that you're being filibustered, or do you feel that the administration is just using this national security response as a convenient out to avoid the tough questions?
I don't know. All I know at this point is we were told we could not be given answers because of the Mousawi trial, of the possible danger to its sources and methods, and to the fact that some of the information we had is misinformation. Now, we've gone back and we've double-checked our sources and we've further researched it, and we're in the process of developing a letter to be sent out to the FBI saying, hey, you said this was misinformation. Here's the information we have. You know, please hold a press conference. Set the record straight. The more information the public has with regard to things that we can know, the safer this country will be.
Do you think you and the other family members are going to organize to try and demand any sort of action around this?
I mean, I think we're doing all we can at this point. I mean, we are demanding action. We're demanding answers. It's a matter of, you know, you really, apparently 3,000 lives lost are not enough to get answers. Apparently, you know, more people need to be killed for this country to shape up its act. And I think that's deplorable. I think it is so disheartening. But apparently that's what it's going to take. And I know that when that happens, I will have peace in my heart knowing that I did everything that I could possibly do to make the nation safe. And whether people in Washington can do that, that's a whole different story.
Kristen Breitweiser, the widow of Ronald Breitweiser, who was working in Tower 2 on the 94th floor on September 11, 2001. Among the more outspoken critics of the Bush administration's handling of the 911 investigation is former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney from Georgia, whose comments drew the ire of right-wing pro-Israel supporters of the war and led to a campaign to oust her from her congressional seat. That campaign was inevitably successful. In his recent book, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, investigative journalist Greg Palas uncovers scandal, corruption, and lies in the White House and corporate America, as well as what he calls lies and allies in the corporate press regarding the case of McKinney. In an article published last week on the alternet.org website entitled The Screwing of Cynthia McKinney, Palas writes, according to those quoted on National Public Radio, McKinney's a loose cannon who the people of Atlanta are embarrassed and disgusted by, and she is also loony and dangerous. McKinney implied that the Bush administration knew in advance about September 11th and deliberately held back the information. Palas continues, the New York Times' Lynette Clementson revealed her comments went even further over the edge. Quote, Ms. McKinney suggested that President Bush might have known about the September 11th attacks, but did nothing so his supporters could make money in war, unquote. Problem is, the quote from McKinney is a complete fabrication, a whopper, a fabulous fib, a fake, a flimflam, just freaking made up, Greg Palas on the alternate.org website writes. Mark Babawi from Pacifica Station KPFT spoke recently with Palast about his article and the information he uncovered.
So the first thing you get, to use the phrase of V.S. Naipaul, the Nobel Prize winner in literature, they don't lie so often. They lied. They just don't give you the news. There's a statement from Cynthia McKinney. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney said that before September 11th, George Bush knew about the attack coming and failed to warn anyone so that his friends could make some profit. It was an astonishing statement by Congresswoman McKinney, and it was repeated in almost every major newspaper in the country, including national, and then also on National Petroleum Radio. There was one problem with the quote. It was a complete fabrication. She never said it. They just said she said it. They didn't say, by the way, that she's reported to have said. They didn't say she denied the quote. They just ran it as true, and so she was labeled by the Democratic Party itself as a lunatic, as a nutcase, and they went after her, and she lost her seat in Congress on the basis of a fabricated quote.
And what she actually said was that he had no prior knowledge.
She said very clearly, it's right in the congressional record, that of course George Bush had no prior knowledge. What she was talking about, actually, frankly, was she was referring to a report done by BBC Television, by me. I'm a reporter for BBC Television, and there's a subsection in the book, and the title chapter is called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and the subchapter is called Did the President Spike the Investigation of Bin Laden, of the Bin Ladens and Funding of Terrorism? It's an important story, and it is a shocking story by itself, which is that prior to September 11th, FBI agents had wanted to investigate the American side of the Bin Laden family, and they could not. In addition, in fact, Friday I just broadcast new news on this report, on BBC Television, not exactly your pirate radio station operation, BBC of Britain, the number one news station on the planet, and we reported the information that the Bush administration had in the summer of 2001 dismantled the unit in charge of investigating the financing of terrorism, the financing of Al-Qaeda, And, of course, also in the summer of 2001, the Bush administration had removed from Yemen, removed from Yemen the FBI team investigating al-Qaeda headed by the FBI al-Qaeda unit, John O'Neill, who then resigned in protest. Now, this information was known to Congresswoman McKinney because she reads my reports and she listens to Pacifica Radio. So she reads my reports on BBC television. So she thought these things should be investigated. This is not about George Bush knowing in advance about September 11th. This is about intelligence failures.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, you know, what did people know? When did they know it? Why didn't they give us more warnings about this stuff? Why were they pulling back? And we talk a lot about in our program, every expert says a lot of it had to do with the presidential family's connection to Saudi Arabians that backed their oil businesses. In other words, the idea was we don't investigate our friends. I mean, that seemed to be the message that was going around the intelligence community.
Now, McKinney, sorry to interrupt, McKinney wanted something else investigated as well. She wanted you and others and even the Congress to look at Barrick gold mining.
Yes, and that's another thing wasn't mentioned. So what happened is that, number one, all she did was call for an investigation of a story that didn't even make the U.S. press, let alone, and she just called for an investigation. So what they do is they take her words. In other words, instead of just saying, listen, there's an important issue to be investigated, they don't cover the main news that everyone else in the world is listening to. The one woman who brings it up is vilified and for bringing it up, and what they do is they take her words and they twist them to say that, you know, Bush knew in advance. And finally, but then they don't tell you why they went after this woman, because she was investigating something else. She was in charge of a congressional investigation, something called Barrick Gold Mining. Now, Barrick Gold Mining, you will not read in the American press, is a gold mining company which had on its payroll George Bush Sr. And there are a lot of interesting favors done for Barrick Gold Mining. Before Bush left office, Barrick Gold Mining was allowed to lay claim to a U.S. gold mine in Nevada, their Canadian company, which was worth which had $10 billion worth of gold ore in it, and they paid the U.S. Treasury $10,000 on the older Prospectors Claim Act. It's an astonishing story, and Barrick, by the way, doesn't deny it. But their best bet is that they like to harass and harangue and even sue reporters who report it. I know because they sued my papers, and we beat the hell out of them in Britain. I also write for The Guardian, which is the world's main newspaper, and McKinney was investigating this company which is George Bush's company, for their involvement in possibly helping fund both sides of the civil war in the Congo, which is costing 3 million lives. And there was a question, and she was in charge of the committee investigating whether Barrick was fueling this bloody civil war. She knew, though, she made the mistake. She knew that George Bush was on the Barrick payroll. That was mistake one. Mistake two, she didn't realize that she was also being harassed. The New York Times said, for example, that Atlanta's black leadership had abandoned her. And they specifically meant Andrew Young and Vernon Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
What the New York Times didn't mention is that Andrew Young and Vernon Jordan were on the payroll of Barrick Gold Mining. And so, in other words, all the news that's fit to print, what you get in your press, if anything, is you get, you know, cracked Cynthia McKinney accuses the president of planning the September 11th attack, and then all the, you know, everyone abandoned her because she's crazy. What they don't say is that she never said it. She denies saying it. They don't give her a chance to even respond to this, by the way. They talk about her being abandoned by all reasonable black people. They cite hand us two names without saying that these are people she's investigating.
Now, McKinney obviously made a tactical error in approaching the situation the way she did.
No kidding.
But how would someone, I'm asking you obviously to speculate here, but if someone was in her position and had that kind of information, obviously the out in the open attack is not the best way to do it, because we've seen the consequences of that. But what should she have done, and what can people do generally if they're in a position of some influence? I mean, how could she have handled it better?
Well, there's two things, and I don't know. I mean, I've been speaking to her lately. By the way, you know, her statement, the statement that they quote most often is from one of your sister Pacifica stations. She gave an interview. What they did was they took lines from the interview out of context and reran them on NPR. And yeah, it's just quite amazing, the twist. And, you know, I think in McKinney's case, she, you know, maybe she should have screamed and hollered that, you know, they had, you know, but it was very, very difficult to do. Once they had her tagged and targeted, it was, you know, I actually asked the New York Times reporter, you'll see it's kind of humorous, actually, if you read the story, because I actually get the Times reporter on tape talking about, well, where did you get this stuff? You know, where did you get this quote? And she said, well,
it was everywhere.
You know, she says, oh, it was all over the place. Well, of course, after the New York Times reports that it's all over the place, you know. And I said, well, you know, I'm at BBC. We got to have a better source than that. Then you know, she's going round and round from the congressional record. It's not, you know, she's kind of like, they're totally faking it. You know, that's the grand irony of it all. You know, they're just totally faking it. And the idea, there is an assumption that these are major news sources, very, very serious news sources. But they don't know. They're picking this stuff up. The stuff gets planted with them, by the way. They didn't just pick on McKinney just by accident. But they don't even know it. They're quite pathetic. They're quite pathetic.
Greg Palast, the author of The Best Money Democracy Can Buy, speaking with Mark Babawi from Pacific Station KPFT. We go now to the Christmas Coup comedy players and listen in on a private conversation at the White House as Bush suggests his preference for the Democratic Party nominee for the 2004 presidential election.
We take you now live to the Oval Office where Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice are meeting with the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
I have decided, guys,
yeah.
I'm going to support Al Sharpton. The Reverend Al Sharpton.
Al?
The doctor, Reverend.
Yeah. Doctor?
Al Sharpton, to run against me for president of the United States. I want to promote
well,
him.
That's...
I want him, with the Democratic Party, to nominate him.
Whew, that's good, Mr. President, as long as you don't tell anybody.
I want to tell everybody, Connie.
Oh.
Be honest and open and above board.
Well, you know, that sounds good, Mr. President.
But honesty is not always the best policy, Mr. President.
I want to run against Al Sharpton.
Well, we'd love to have him, Mr. President. We're already lining up some anonymous donors.
I don't want anonymous donors, Dick.
Huh?
Nobody knows who they are.
Well, that's true.
You don't need Al Sharpton, Mr. President. You can beat any Democrat they put up against you.
Well, that's right.
I want Sharpton. I want the Rev. I want the Rev.
Well,
with the funny hair.
There could be a miracle. We could pray they nominate Sharpton.
Right.
We can't underestimate the power of prayer, Mr. President.
That's a point.
I love prayer,
uh-huh.
Connie.
Uh-huh.
So does Sharpton. Prays a lot. I know that.
Yeah.
And those prayer breakfasts,
mm-hmm.
I love those. Hey, where are you going to eat waffles without a prayer breakfast?
That's right. It's a good place.
That's,
you know, Sharpton's a good choice, Mr. President. We'd be lucky to get him.
I plan to see to it. I plan to see that we do get him, Dick.
Uh-huh.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's why I've decided to pay every voter in the New Hampshire primary $100 to vote for Al Sharpton to be the nominee of the Democratic Party of the United States.
It's a good idea, Mr. President.
It will actually make you the first president to publicly endorse a candidate from the opposing political party, Mr. President.
Mm-hmm. I like to be the first president to do certain things.
Yes. Yeah.
You know,
well, that's good to be.
With you guys?
It's good to be first, Mr. President.
Uh-huh.
Very good.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Glad you're catching on.
Yeah.
Yes. I am the first president to appear in public wearing a military uniform. You seen that before?
Yeah.
Not
no.
even Grant.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. George Washington refused to wear his while he was president.
Yeah.
Maybe George Washington didn't love America as much as I do.
Well, you know? Probably not, Mr. President.
No, it's true. Compared to you,
a smaller country.
Compared to you, Mr. President, George Washington was almost a traitor.
Almost.
I think so. I'm the first president to fly a fighter jet onto an aircraft carrier. Washington didn't do that.
No.
I watched the video over and over.
I
love it.
Millard Fillmore couldn't do that.
No.
So do I, Connie.
Yeah.
I watch the video all the time. It's
you do?
Great.
Uh-huh.
Great. Hey.
Great.
When can I do that again, man?
Well, you know, Mr. President, we're working on your idea of having you shot out of a cannon for the 4th of July, Mr. President.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to be on fire for that one. Is that possible?
Well,
can I be on fire?
I think so.
Well,
the
Secret Service is looking for flame-retardant business suits, Mr. President.
I don't want flame-retardant, Connie. I want to be spectacular.
Spectacular. Spectacular is good.
Uh-huh.
And Now, while we're at it, guys, get one of those fire suits for Sharpton. I'm going to invite him to get shot out of a cannon with me. We'll see who goes the greater distance and who has a longer flame.
The Christmas Coup comedy players of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.